around the room. Let's wait for two seats.
Certainly go this way.
I could go that way.
True, we could go clockwise.
Yeah. Les Sendel, I'm a member of this committee and president of the board of directors.
Desert Healthcare District.
Desert Healthcare District and Foundation.
I'm Chris Christensen, current interim CEO and chief financial officer here at the district.
I'm Andrea Hales. I'm the special assistant to the CEO and the board relations officer.
I am Stephen Hike. I am the accounting manager.
Your turn.
Oh. I think I am the interpreter.
What's your name?
Itai.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'm Mitch Blumberg, chairman of the governing board of the S Regional Medical Center.
Great. Linda Evans, chief strategy officer for the Desert Care Network.
I'm Michelle Finney, CEO for Desert Regional.
Christine Langenwalter, chief quality officer. For Desert.
Uh-huh.
Ezra. Ezra Kaufman, district resident.
Peter Richardson, incoming president of the auxiliary board.
Thank you. And I'm Carol Rogers. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mary Gugin, that president.
I'm sorry, could you say your name out loud?
Mary Pugin, deaf resident, Palm Springs.
Welcome, Mary. I know that.
Matching names.
Great. Next is approval of the agenda. Is there any more items that want to be added to the agenda? If not?
I move for approval.
Okay, second, and all in favor? Aye. Okay. At this time, we have comments from the audience may be made on items not listed on the agenda that are of public interest and within the subject matter jurisdiction of the district. The committee has a policy of limiting speakers to not more than 3 minutes. The committee cannot take action on items not listed on the agenda. Public input may be offered on an agenda item when it comes up for discussion and or action. Yay! Okay. Mary, you're on.
Hello, thank you, and good morning. Again, my name is Mary Ann Pugin. And I'm one of three of the people in the Coachella Valley. I'm on a committee called the Coachella Valley Deaf Core Committee. The other two people on that committee, Philip Rubin and Ken Mikos, he couldn't come today. The three of us on that core committee. We typically advocate for deaf citizens, deaf rights, deaf residents and visitors of the Coachella Valley. In the different venues related to business or services, including healthcare, medical, emergency facilities, like here in the hospital. The thing we advocate for most would be like deaf sensitivity, language accessibility, interpreting, closed captioning. And that's a few things that we advocate for here in the Coachella Valley. The three of us had a very productive meeting in June with very key people here at Desert Regional Medical Center. Our dialogue was related to accessibility predominantly at this hospital. The three of us, we plan to have another meeting with those key people in the future to discuss further accessibility issues. The three of us also plan to get in contact with the Desert Healthcare District and Desert Healthcare Foundation to ask for a meeting to have a dialogue with those people as well. the topic of that meeting would be the same: accessibility for deaf people, interpreters, etc. Thank you for the opportunity to give my comment. Thank you for having an ASL interpreter at your meeting today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to make a statement? Hearing none, we need to approve the meeting minutes from the last meeting. Did you have any changes?
No changes. Move for approval.
Okay. Anybody else had any changes? All right. Seconded. All in favor, aye. Do we have any old business? No? New business. Desert Regional Medical Center Emergency Room Department Project. Would that be Ms. Finney?
That would be me. So what I was hoping to do today is orient the group and talk a little bit about some of the things that we have in the making with regard to urgent cares, emergency room services, and as well as some new programs that we've brought to market to try to further improve some of the experience and coordination and thought processes wrapped around kind of right care, right place. So from the agenda, I really kind of blended items one and items two into one package review. And so if we start, what I'd like to do is cover our urgent care expansion that is underway, as well as our emergency room department remodel and what some of the components of that remodel and thought processes wrapped around that remodel are. Talk a little bit about the Emergency Room Express program and a care continuity program, the latter two designed to do better coordination of care and handoff between care providers. And hopefully I'll get this thing to go the right way. So starting on the topic of urgent cares, what you have before you is really a listing of all of the services that are provided under the wraparound brand of Desert Care Network. And what this is it's the acute care facilities, it's the outpatient platform for urgent cares, ambulatory surgery centers, imaging services, as well as the physician reach on primary care and specialty care. So the two newest elements that we have joining us is a MedPost, which is an urgent care in North Indio, as well as a MedPost that's located in Palm Desert. We currently have a MedPost located in La Quinta. So the MedPost that's in Palm Desert is going to be located on Town Center Way. And the MedPost in Palm Desert is going to be located.
Whole Food Shop.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Whole Food Shop.
North India. There we go. Avenue 42. So you can tell I do not have these street addresses memorized. Tenet has a division, so the hospital will not be running these med posts. We actually have a separate division that works with the urgent cares. And currently we have about 80 urgent cares that are under the med post umbrella. And most of those urgent cares are in California, Texas, and Arizona. So we have three, we'll have three out in this area with plans to expand with a couple additional sites over time. And we have several out in the Orange County, Long Beach location. For this particular area, we are co-branding them with the MedPost Urgent Care as well as the Desert Care Network branding logos, which is what you see here. The brand tagline is improving how people experience healthcare. Some of the services that are offered at the MedPost clinics, we generally operate them Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., Saturdays, Sundays, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. They are staffed with either a physician and a nurse practitioner, a combination thereof. And they will be offering some in-house lab and some x-ray. And this is pretty basic labs and x-rays. So for your reference, we have a list here of what some of the services that we generally see in those urgent care centers. And a lot of them are your lower acuity type visits that people can't get into their physician offices within you know, the desired amount of time, or they're not really sure whether they have a more acute event occurring, and so they go to the med post for some screening exams. And so that's a little bit about some of the urgent care development that's going on. These are scheduled to open August 15th.
excuse me. I mean, it's great as far as what Desert Health Network is doing, but I'm mostly concerned about what's going on around Desert Regional Medical Center and access to urgent care services to also take off load from the ER. And I'm glad you're doing that for the community, but again, we're focused here on hospital governance. And are there plans to do urgent care around here so that we can take some pressure off the ER? And I know you're going to talk about what's going on in the ER, but to me,
right,
that is more important from our point of view.
Okay. So we do have some plans. Those aren't plans that, the reason why I can share the two I'm sharing with you is because they are public knowledge. And so we are in negotiations for some additional build of an ambulatory platform, but we're not to the point right now where I'm really getting into detail with this.
And I understand, I can appreciate that,
but there are,
again, I think, again, looking at it only mm-hmm. from my narrow view of this building over here, that's really important to relieve pressure off the ER.
Yes.
Wasn't there an urgent care center on the corner here that operated, or?
There is a closed urgent care that was operated by a private individual.
Across the street.
Across the street.
Across the street. Mm-hmm.
That had nothing to do.
Was it affiliated?
Unaffiliated.
No.
It's unaffiliated, and that individual, although still holds the lease on that urgent care site, is not operating in that urgent care site any longer.
Mm-hmm. For some reason, I was informed that it was somehow affiliated with the hospital.
No.
Even went there once.
No, we have an employee health provider that's in that building that we're contracted with, that we do use for like pre-employment screens and some minor employee issues, but that particular location is not affiliated. So if we go a little bit more local, we'll get you to the emergency room.
Okay.
And so we are in the process of doing an emergency room remodel and upgrade. To give you an idea of the scope of that particular project, phase one involves the conversion of some support office space into actual treatment bays. That phase has been completed by way of the construction for four additional treatment locations is done. It's been signed off by OSHPD, it's been signed off by the fire marshal, and we are awaiting the CDPH to come out and actually license those beds. So as soon as the CDPH licenses those beds, we will be putting them into service. And we do expect that to hopefully happen in about a month, or sometime over the month. So we have our applications in. There's certain sequencing to these things, and until OSHPD signs off and the fire marshal signs off, you can't notify CDPH that you're ready for survey. So then when you notify and you're ready for survey, they put you in the review queue. The second phase of the project.
And just, can I just quantitatively, that increases your beds by 20%?
We will be going from 27 license bays to 31 license bays.
So about 10%.
So four. So the four additional. We're seeing about 6,400 visits per month. And we are seeing a decrease in the lower acuity visits. The second phase of the project is the lobby and the intake areas. And really what part of the goal and the objective is here is to improve the we will be eliminating the cubicles that are out in the waiting area. And so that will be moved to a private location. So we're trying to increase the privacy of the patients, eliminate those lobby cubicles, and then remodel the lobby to be used just strictly as a lobby area. And so this will just provide for improved patient flow. There are a couple objectives in what we're looking to accomplish with this emergency room remodel. We're currently running about a 3% what we call walkout rate. And those are people who, prior to completion of their treatment, leave. And the goal is to get that walkout rate to 2% or less. We've actually had a very good improvement over the last 3 years in lowering the walkout rate and increasing the amount of turnaround time to get a patient pulled back to a provider, evaluated, and have the care process start. But we're still not where we want to be. So this was designed to actually improve some of those areas that are key measures for us, which is the turnaround time to either the admit of a patient or the treating and releasing of the individual back to their home or destination. So again, this is just showing you that we're increasing the actual treatment space from the 27 current beds to the 31 beds. And that's just a picture of what the new space looks like.
So we're still not, we're talking about beds with curtains.
Yes.
Yeah. And is that a problem with patient confidentiality? And I mean, I've been in the emergency mm-hmm. room with my husband, and
mm-hmm.
one, the poor lady next to us was almost deaf, and
staff had to speak loudly.
Had to talk very loud.
Listen, the staff does try to maintain as much patient confidentiality as possible. We have a restricted physical plant that we can work within through some of the OSHPOD parameters. So, we're just trying to get the most treatment space that we possibly can, because pulling people out of the hallway and out of the lobby
mm-hmm.
is a higher level
sure.
of confidentiality. But we can't, the physical plant space itself would not allow for meeting code and building out to a walled situation.
I know you know this, but for everybody else's yeah. benefit, just a reminder that it's not only the inflow into the ER, but it's the
exactly.
outflow. And in a hospital, in an ER, with a hospital, you're really dependent on having beds to put people in and
mm-hmm.
staff for those beds. To put people in, and of course this is all complicated by the large number of 5150s that are looking for an inpatient mental facility, psychiatric facility that are not available. So it's a complicated thing, and I think adding the 4 beds is certainly a great step. Where obviously you're looking at the input through urgent care clinics, but also the output and ability to transfer the patient to a hospital bed or somewhere else.
So I think to put it in a little bit of perspective, as the industry has been evolving, as managed care evolves, as some of the efforts that we talk about here that we have in really trying to have the right care in the right place with people establishing a relationship with a primary care provider, we have seen a decrease in the increase of emergency room visits, and particularly of your lower acuity emergency room visits. So just to place it in perspective, the 2014 year, we saw an 8% growth in ER visits. Then the 15 year, that growth slowed to a 7% increase. In the 16 year, the growth further slowed to a 4% increase. And in the 27 year, it was less than a 1% increase. And when we go through a deeper level, it's in those diagnoses you would expect. It's in otitis media, it's in fever of unknown origin, it's in your more diffuse symptoms of I have abdominal pain, I have back pain. And so we are, I think, starting to see the beginning of some shift to how people are seeking care. I'm sure some of it is economically driven, I think some of it is better care coordination driven, and some of it is your managed care providers, as you have groups like IHP and DOHC, Kaiser, really working with their individuals to provide them access to care and appropriate access to outpatient care. So in February, we onboarded what is called ER Express. And how ER Express works is we want people to feel that they can go to an urgent care, go to a PCP, and then if they need a higher level of care, they can get that higher level of care in a coordinated, expedited fashion. So what ER Express does is it is a method for an outpatient care provider to be able to say, I have seen this individual, I have assessed their current condition, I've made a determination that they need to go to the hospital. So they fill out a form that gets sent over to us. So we know that patient, what their current condition is, what their care provider believes they're going to require, and we can do a warm handoff from a different level of care and then pull them into the emergency room in a more expeditious process, because we know they've gone through that pre-screening process. When the request is entered into the computer system, it then gives us a mechanism to be able to provide feedback back to that care provider on what actually was the workup, the diagnosis, and then the next step in the care. And so this is just a little bit about, a little bit about that. So part of a couple key points, because again, we're trying to increase the way you're coordinating care, is we ask them if we've seen the patient before, so that we can then know they're coming and pull their prior records to be prepared for what may be needed. And then we ask them for the information so that we can then send the patient back to the appropriate outpatient care provider. And so that has actually proven to be pretty effective. We launched in February, and as you can see, each month we're seeing some incremental increase in the number of outpatient care providers that are using the tool and referring over for that continuation of care, and then the potential handback of that person's care. Then the other...
Can you go back for a second?
I can.
I'm sorry. First of all, I think it's great. How will all primary care doctors in the community have access
to
this?
They will. All urgent cares, all primary cares, anyone that wants to
including networks like Desert Oasis and IEHP and Kaiser,
yes,
et cetera.
Great. Yes.
Secondly,
and the next program I'm going to show you is very heavily used by DOHC and some of the managed care providers.
Great.
So it's brand new, and we're just soft launching it. All three hospitals have the tool.
Okay. It'd be interesting to see. I would expect, since they've been pre-screened, that a higher percentage would have been admitted. But maybe they weren't.
Yeah.
They weren't sent over for admission, but just for acute treatment.
Well, there a lot of times it is acute treatment, and if you look at some of the individuals that can participate in this, you know, you have with skilled facilities and assisted living, you know, they don't always have doctors on site, so they might tend to send over people that you would expect that you could render some kind of treatment, have prescriptions, make sure they're okay, and then be able to send them back.
Maybe they need diagnostic imaging,
yeah,
or something like that.
I think it'd be helpful to have that a little bit, that data, so that it would be nice to know what is the number of people that were sent over that maybe didn't really need to be sent over, so you could focus on what can we do to lessen that amount.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, could be treatment but discharged could be another block on the right.
Well, it would be the difference between the 85 and the 23, because the 23 were admitted, so the 85 would have been discharged.
Right, but the question is, all those patients discharged, did they really need to come to the ER for a treatment that couldn't have been given
on an outpatient basis?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In other words, if somebody,
yeah,
gets sent over for suturing, that's a treatment, a necessary treatment. And hopefully that will go up to the total amount, but
mm-hmm,
it would be valuable, I think, for both the senders and the receivers,
mm-hmm,
to know, well, what are the kinds of patients that are being sent that really don't need to be here, so that you could focus on getting that number even lower.
We just have to share that cautiously because of our EMTALA,
mm-hmm,
regulations. We can't be perceived as trying to redirect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
right. And you also have an online make an appointment with the ER.
Yes.
And how is that functioning?
That's actually functioning very well. So we have a very, I didn't bring those statistics, but that actually has been in place for over a year, and it's a pretty high usage.
Is it just directed to a time that's not so busy, or what does
yes.
it do?
So what it does is it gives people the option of saying, I want to come to the emergency room, and then they can, if the algorithm will say, well, it looks like this time is less busy, so a person can sign up on an approximate time that they'll be arriving.
And do they, when they get there, then are they put in front of the queue?
They are put within a 15-minute arrival of the queue. Okay. Now that obviously will change depending on the acuity of the patients, if a trauma comes in or a code comes in, but we have what we refer to normally as sort of our fast track beds. And so when we look to book a person, then we usually book them on those lower acuity beds, because obviously they're not so emergent that they're right. calling an ambulance or coming in another right. mechanism.
And back to trauma beds, I know that you have true trauma mm-hmm. rooms. Mm-hmm. When they're not being used, are they used for other, or just trauma only?
Right. We hold those for trauma.
And is that sufficient? Just two rooms for the area that mm-hmm. you haven't had a problem?
Nope, I haven't. And actually, our trauma numbers have been pretty stable over time. So the last area that I was going to review with you is called the Care Continuity Program. And this is on, now I just reviewed with you the program to try to manage a better experience and a warm handoff on the front end of the care. Care Continuity is on the back end of the care. And so what Care Continuity does is we have nine navigators, and these navigators work with patients that are being seen in the emergency room to make their post-care transitions. If you're an IPA, and a lot of the IPAs, some of them, we've had about 142 doctors that have signed up for the Care Continuity platform. Most of our managed affiliates have also signed up for the Care Continuity platform. Because when we register the patient, if the provider opts for it, the system will send out an alert to that provider to let them know that their patient has just registered in an emergency room, so that that provider then has an opportunity to provide information, to call the facility, to call the patient, to hold a conversation so that they have an awareness that one of an individual under their care has presented for emergency room treatment. The IPAs generally use it as an alert because a lot of these IPAs have navigators and case managers that are stationed at the hospital. So those navigators will go down to the emergency room and try to provide assistance to the patient that has presented. And so I know this is a little bit of a busy slide, but it's just to give you a sense of the number of contacts that these care navigators are having at Desert. And so you'll see it's about 3,200 patients that are screened per month. That of those patients, they are generally booking follow-up appointments. About 1,500 of those patients required an actual care navigator that went in and coordinated between their insurance coverage, who's a contracted provider, and the patient has given consent for them to go ahead and book them a post-hospital visit follow-up appointment. And then of the 1,500, and this is just a snapshot of the month of June, of the 1,500 appointments that are set up, about 850 up, one of them were new provider appointments. So they truly were individuals who didn't necessarily have a relationship established with a physician who can provide them continuation care. This has been a wonderfully received tool by the medical staff, the IPAs, and the patients. It really helps them be able to know that they have that follow-up appointment, and that we know who to communicate their clinical information to, so that they don't get subject to redundant testing.
Are we able to send ER notes
yes.
to those patients? Mm-hmm. Or?
Yeah. When a doctor signs up for the program, they can actually go through and indicate what reports they want us to send them. Most of the IPAs prefer that we hand the planning off to their particular care manager. So the element of this program that most of the IPAs are most excited about is the fact that they get that real time. A member, one of your enrollees, just registered in the emergency
room. Right, but I'm thinking of it from the point of view of a primary care physician in an IPA or an HMO. When the patient comes to see me a week or two later,
mm-hmm.
will I have
yes.
the discharge papers, the medications, the labs that were done, and how do they get that? Is it up to the IPA to provide it, or
well, they can have portal access, but when they register to participate in the program, the IPA would indicate which reports they want us to send. Most of the IPAs have asked we not send direct to the doctor, that we send to their case managers, and that their case managers will then be the one to get those reports to the physician provider that they feel needs those reports. Most of the FIFAS independent physicians, they're going through check-ins, send me your labs, send me your x-rays, send me the doc note. So they're and then those we just auto-transmit.
Do you also have the same kind of service for inpatient?
Okay. We have a service for inpatient. What we do on the inpatient side currently is there's an algorithm that identifies people that are at risk for readmit. All patients that are on the report for being at risk for readmit has a navigator that then assists in their post-discharge planning. We have we are thinking about trying to enhance that program and extend it to more patient population. But we're, about 4 months into doing the inpatient side. So we only do those individuals that are on the high risk for readmit report.
And all the HMOs and IPAs have their own
case managers. They do.
That transmit that information.
They do.
I know at a board meeting, hospital board meeting several mm-hmm. years ago, I think it was Dr. Bodka, said that the computer system for the hospital in inpatient side didn't have the ability to notify the patient's primary care doctor of the fact that they'd been admitted, and that there was some discussion about making that feature come up through the hospital's own system and notify. When a patient arrives is admitted in the hospital, mm-hmm. maybe through the ED, that their physician is notified.
If they sign up for the care continuity tool, they get the alert.
Okay.
But they have to sign up to be
so
part of
that. That's part of that.
Yeah.
Great. That'll make him happy.
I think he signed up for this. I don't know for sure, but I think he is.
Yeah. Great. Are there any questions from anybody here? Ms. Mary, do you have questions?
Can I make a comment about the doctors?
Yeah.
Sure.
So my only kind of warning, I know where you're going, and I think you're on the right track, but as a paramedic, I worked in San Francisco, we have a city-owned, it's actually a licensed acute care hospital, Guadalajara Hospital, but it's also a SNF, a subacute. The attending staff are all gray-haired UCSF professors, excellent people. They're in-house during the day, on call at night. They have family medicine residents in-house 24 hours a day, multiple, and there's like six residents. But they'll call, activate 911 to transfer a patient to UC or San Francisco General because they assume they're going to be admitted to critical care. And most of the time, they're sent back because there's not critical care beds. But they feel that the patient needs a higher level of care, and the problem is they're at the mercy of the hospital they sent to when not only their interpretation of the patient is, but the availability is simply a problem. The other thing is, I saw with my mom, being Kaiser, she had a 12-day rehab stay for a hip fracture repair. Kaiser has 6-day-a-week geriatrician that comes in to the SNF every day, spends 20 or 30 minutes with the patient. The problem she would run into with some of the patients is either cardiology, kind of the protocol would indicate cardiology needs to see the patient if they don't come to the SNF, Palm's the local ED. They use a telerobot. Matter of fact, Palm Desert Clinic here has the telerobot for neurology. So they'd have to transport the patient to Kaiser ED, do a CT scan probably or MRI, and then the teleneurology consult or an actual neurologist, and again, frequently transport back.
Well, that, I mean, you're right, but that's really a community issue for all of the hospitals and all of the providers. I don't know any specialists that make rounds to SNFs and nursing homes and things like that. It really boils down to what you were saying, coordination and expectation.
Right.
And I think that what we're seeing, especially in SNFs, you know, the patients that are in SNFs today are the patients that were in general hospital beds 30 years ago. And the patients that are in general hospital beds now are really the patients that were in the ICU 30 years ago. The whole level of care being provided is very different. So I think eventually that, and I think Michelle agrees with me, that there'll probably be more freestanding ERs mm-hmm. where a patient can be sent there to get the scan, to have access to specialty care if necessary and things like that. But it's a community problem. Eisenhower, same thing. If you're an Eisenhower patient and you're in a SNF or in board and care or assisted living, the specialists don't go out there.
Right, and I guess my point is, I actually disagree. I think we're gonna end up with less emergency departments with more acute care. But the issue is these patients are sicker. There's problems getting access to specialists out in the community. You're not going to call the cardiologist down come over to your primary care doc and see it. But also patients, you have to realize the patients out in the field, like an asthma patient, may just need a couple hours of continuous NEBS, some salmeterol, and they're good to go home. And even again, in years past, they may not have, you know, they may have gotten admitted or something. And now there's, you know, additional medications they can be added on to and sent home. So I think it's kind of a bad endpoint saying, oh, they didn't get admitted.
I agree. I see the point you're trying to make. That's why I want to know what was treated.
Right.
Because the goal is not to admit everybody that comes in.
Right.
The goal is to make sure that everybody that's referred to the ER was appropriate.
Right.
They were either admitted or treated and then sent home, and that there were very few patients that really didn't need to be transported. Mm-hmm. That's all.
And I guess my final question is four new beds adequate for the need of the community? Have you looked beyond today and
you know,
I think
given the slowing down of the growth rate of emergency room visits and given that there's a lot more options available to get people connected to primary care, and I think that's really what has bogged down emergency rooms the most, are those low acuity visits of people who just don't have primary care providers. And as we get these tools in place and the relationships start to get established, mm-hmm. I mean, at first I would say these growth rates, the ER had massive growth rates before coverage expansion. You know, now then when they got coverage expansion, everybody had access to care, so they went up. But now they're getting relationships, and
right.
So I don't think necessarily there's going to be a huge need for massive ER expansion plans. I think that that doing the right thing is to get folks to urgent cares, to primary care. We have seen with the residency programs, you know, we have an outpatient family medicine clinic. We have an outpatient internal medicine clinic, and the number of visits those centers are having, the UCR family medicine, I mean, it's just exponentially, like 30,000 visits in the family medicine mm-hmm. clinic. That didn't exist a couple years ago. So, you know, so those providers, the FQHCs that are seeing a lot of the individuals.
And
so I think it is going to be a right care, right place, and I think the focus needs to be on these types of tools to make sure that people are getting to that right care provider and right level of care. And you have the safety net for the really acute.
I think that's why I keep harping on urgent care, because yeah. on a Saturday night, there is no way you can get a hold of your primary care doctor. And if you need to be seen, and I'll just use an example. I'm a Kaiser member. Mm-hmm. Supposedly the closest urgent care is in La Quinta. And no offense to La Quinta, yeah. but if I'm not feeling well, I don't really want to drive to La Quinta.
Right.
And if there's an urgent care here, I will go to the urgent care. But there isn't, so I'll go to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm. And I know, believe me, I would love the Umtala laws to change to allow for us to do a warm handoff to get someone to the right care, because we'd open the family medicine clinic till midnight tomorrow.
Well,
if I could actually, because by the time we meet the triage protocols,
right.
we've already treated the individual, low acute patient. So I'm not doing them a service by sending them over at that point in time. I'm doing a better service by just completing the needs.
No, I understand, but it's the fact that they don't have any place else to go, that they appear in the ER mm-hmm. and they have to be triaged. And as you said, once they're triaged, then it's a treatment that maybe takes a half hour. You don't want to send them over.
You don't want to start over.
Yeah.
And I know several of the hospitals I've worked at in the past have had the ability for a primary care physician in evening hours, whatever, to refer their patient to the hospital's lab and x-ray department so that, you know, they're not waiting until the next day or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of my neighbor who needed an ultrasound that wasn't available for a week or something like that. Is that I have seen hospitals that would allow one of their practicing physicians to refer a patient in the evening or weekends, whatever,
mm-hmm.
for that kind of stuff. Is there any thinking about that?
Well, that's done now through somebody to report the report to, and so usually it's done through the ER. But I guess there could theoretically be creative, but that actually would be through radiology, and then is radiology going to take the responsibility to get the report read, report it to the doctor, and then more importantly, provide disposition to the patient? I think that's hard.
Because usually those ultrasounds are you're trying to rule out DVT.
Yeah,
you're trying to rule out.
I mean,
if you have to do it at night, it's an urgent kind of thing.
I would send them over to the ER and say he's going to need an ultrasound to rule out a DVT, and it would be up to the report would have to go to the ER doctor to say you don't have a DVT, you can go home.
That's part of the first program that I shared with you, the ED Express, is that doctor could go on the system. He can actually say, I am concerned about a DVT, my patient needs an ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
So the ER doctor wouldn't have to use as many resources to figure out what's going on with that patient, because
mm-hmm.
he has that communication from that PCP. So then we can stay very focused on mm-hmm. what the need is.
I was just thinking of bypassing the
ED altogether.
Yeah.
That would be hard for after hours when you don't have access to those outpatient providers for what you may...
Well, I'm saying that you would have access to the providers.
No, but let's say that it was a DVT and they needed
mm-hmm.
to be treated with sub-Q heparin and sent home, because they don't admit DVTs anymore like they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has to do that, and it wouldn't be the primary doctor at 10 o'clock at night writing for an Allopurinol. What's the injectable heparin mm-hmm. called?
Yeah.
Lovenox. It has to be somebody to deal with it and to document it and to make sure the prescription gets written and filled and a follow-up appointment made, things like that. And right now, the ER is the place for that. In all the systems I know of.
Kaiser does do that. Northern California, some of their call centers even have a physician in house till 11 o'clock. So they'll send you for labs, x-ray, pharmacy,
mm-hmm.
and the A-call, the top call, internal medicine doc, is the responsible party after.
Oh, but that's in their own facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
With their own insurance.
Yeah.
But you never see a physician. You call up, talk to them on the phone, they send you over to do lab, you know, whatever procedures. Even maybe go to pharmacy, get antibiotics or something.
Right, and then they call the on-call person who's in the system, and then the computer can do that.
Right, but and then it gets set on to your primary in the morning.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I was thinking, too, that at San Leandro Hospital, maybe the lab wasn't used that much and they were just looking for new business, and so they really very creatively tried to get outpatient into the hospital lab, and that's probably not the situation.
That wouldn't necessarily be our case. At least not with the number of ER visits we see, mm-hmm. and the census levels of the inpatient.
Right.
We keep folks pretty.
And they would give free mammograms when they were down for charitable organizations. During downtime, you could schedule a mammogram for free through the Family Resource Center. So I mean, there was downtime, obviously, but they could do that. Anything else? Any news about the inpatient psychiatric facility in India?
I have all kinds of news on that facility. Mm-hmm. I have a whole presentation for the board today.
Ooh, okay.
Because the Acadia individual was very, very willing to provide us his information presentation deck.
Yeah, I did see that.
My understanding is that it still has not been approved by India.
It's going through the Planning Commission process.
Planning Commission did a continuation of it back in June.
Right.
And then they approved it at their last meeting to move forward to City Council.
Oh, they did approve it?
They did, 4-0. Yes, there was one absentee. And so it is scheduled for the Indio City Council in mid-August, either 14th, 20th, something like that. So yes, it's moving forward to City Council. And they've held community meetings as well to address the neighborhood.
I'm hoping there's some way that the district can help that along in terms of being there to...
Well, I don't know if the district can formally do that, but I think as individuals we can certainly express to the City Council our hope that this is a very needed service, and that although some people fear that they're afraid of having an inpatient facility is going to make the neighborhood unsafe, I've made the point that it's the patient who is a danger to himself and others that can't get into an acute facility that's a danger to the community, not the one that can get
true,
in.
True.
And so we can certainly, as individuals, encourage other people to go to that meeting and voice other people.
And the criminally insane are going to be in jail, not at this facility.
Not this facility.
I know. They did
a very nice job of going through. I mean, they're high-end, very competent psych organization. And so I think they've done a very nice job in their presentation decks to the community as well as to the planning, and I'm going to assume that the City Council, of really going through their mission, their treatment model, what it is they do to ensure security, you know, how they manage their patients, and then the number of facilities they have, the locations of what their experience has been in different markets. They've gone through and they've identified facilities that are located next to residential areas, located next to schools, and so they have a lot of history and practical experience that they really can call upon.
What will be the association of this facility if it gets placed there with JFK?
We have met with them as the Desert Care Network, both Desert and JFK, and we have talked about wanting to be highly aligned with them.
But doesn't there have to be a formal
There will be things like transfer agreements. They've interviewed us as far as the psych needs that we see in the community, what we experience in our emergency room and our inpatient. Their model is to be located next to an acute care hospital.
I thought there was a requirement. It's not.
It's not a requirement, but it's helpful for them because, you know, they're a psych facility. If something, there's medical needs, they want to know that they're pretty close to an acute care provider.
They did talk about, if I can add, Michelle, shared services
agreement
with the hospital for things like lab and pharmacy and access to specialists, that if they have a medical need while that patient is there under their care, that a physician from the medical staff can assist. They're also projecting to bring on 12 psychiatrists that they've already said would be able to obviously apply for staff privileges in our hospitals.
So their initial plan is 80 beds with with the ability to expand to additional 40.
Mm-hmm. And will they have outpatient facilities for day treatment?
They'll be doing outpatient, and they offer all programs except adolescents. So they don't do 0 to 9 But they do child, adult, geropsych.
Great.
Awesome. Any other questions?
Can I ask if there are any suggestions for topics to be covered at this committee in the future? Obviously, we will do updates on LeapFrog, on CMS, star rating, and updates on the things we've covered before, but are there any other topics that people would like to see covered that have to do with our district's oversight of the lease with Desert Regional Medical Center?
I would like to see an update on the CBRE report in terms of...
Oh, seismic.
Seismic.
Oh, yes, yes.
The condition assessment.
Right.
I did one last month.
The seismic report will be reported to the board.
When it's ready. They're in process. They're working with folks at Desert Regional for so they're working through the seismic assessment.
Ben, any idea when that might be ready?
They're in the phase one, which is the very in-depth process, so mm-hmm. it's probably going to be 5 months, so latter part of the year.
Thank you. Any other ideas?
Okay.
Hearing none, meeting's adjourned.
Great. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.